Well, I would like to start our study for today, little children. It is December 27th, 2022, 17:18 hours, Eastern Standard Time. My name is Ward Green. I would love to share with you, first of all, an interesting scripture that shows why government rulers must be swift in their execution of justice. It's Ecclesiastes 8 and 11. And it says, because sentence against a bad work has not been executed speedily, that is why the heart of the sons of men has become fully set in them to do bad. So when we consider somebody like Pontius Pilate in the Bible, who was the governor of the region in which he was serving, the Roman Empire, he had the duty to execute justice against the criminals and to do so swiftly. And Roman law was in place, of course. It was a very rigid, a very strict system of laws in the Roman Empire that was designed to protect all the citizens of Rome. So a governor had a big responsibility to carry out the execution of justice along with his other duties, of course, whatever they may have been, which would have been, one would imagine, quite multitudinous or quite significant in number concerning all the things he would have to be responsible for. One of which was, of course, the carrying out of the ensuring, that is, of the carrying out of the law. He was not the Justice Department himself. He was responsible for overseeing the justice, that justice was carried out, and to oversee the Department of Justice. But he would not be the only person involved in the execution of justice either. Although he may have been the final, he almost certainly had the final say as the governor. But let's. But the thing is, when Jesus was executed, we saw that the reason why Pontius Pilate was not swift in executing justice against Jesus, actually he was swift because Jesus had done no wrong. So Pilate, when Pilate was questioning, I mean, Jesus broke no law. He broke no laws. Consequently, Pilate had no reason to execute Jesus, and that's why he was slow about doing so. And it was only the Jewish priests who were seeking to have Jesus killed. And Pontius Pilate felt like he had no jurisdiction in this case because Jesus had broken no laws. So that was the reason why Pontius Pilate was not eager to execute Jesus. Now, in our study for today, I would like to do that. What else? Before we start, though, our study for today is going to be, we're not going to have an Isaiah chapter, but we will have, hopefully, Psalm 87. Little children, that's a short one. So we're going to do a short study today, but first I want to watch this video with you. Not all of it, because it's too long, but this, the video with Dr. Mercola of Mercola.com. He's a health practitioner. And Dr. Kate Raume-Bleu, the Canadian naturopathic doctor who is the world's foremost expert on vitamin K2. And she wrote a book called Vitamin K2 and the Calcium Paradox. And Mercola is here interviewing her. So let's listen for a while.
Hello, this is Dr. Mercola, and today I'm joined by Dr. Kate Raume-Bleu, who is a naturopathic physician, and she's the author of Vitamin K2 and the Calcium Paradox, which is a phenomenal book about one of the most important vitamins that we know of, which is vitamin K2, and it's the best book I've read on this highly underappreciated topic. And I'm just delighted to have her here today to share her insights on this really important area. And she comes today from Canada, so thank you for joining us today.
Thanks, I'm glad to be here.
So can you tell us a little bit of how you first, well, tell us a little about your training and how you first became interested in vitamin K2.
Well, I'm a naturopathic doctor, which in Canada, the area I'm in is a licensed primary care physician, mm-hmm. but of course with a keen interest in nutrition.
Do you have the ability to write prescriptions too? Not that I would suggest that you do that, but because I know in some, there's about 5 or 6 states in the United States, maybe more, maybe 10, that naturopathic physicians are licensed and have prescription privileges.
In the province of British Columbia, actually, we have prescribing rights, but I'm in Ontario. We don't have that yet, but we still do, order and interpret blood tests, make diagnoses, and can recommend treatments and prescribe treatments, not prescription drugs just yet.
And you went to the Canadian College?
December 20th.
Naturopathic medicine. I graduated from there. I did my residency at that college and spent some time on the faculty there.
Yeah, that's a bit of an anomaly because I had a relationship with a woman who went to one of the authentic grad schools. You know, the 5 or 6. Yeah. Is it 6 in North America?
6. Yes. 5 or 6.
Yeah. That actually give the 4-year accredited degree.
Right.
And so I actually spoke at that college in Canada once. I would imagine most of the Canadians graduate from that school.
Primarily, and then Boucher Institute in Vancouver is also accredited now. So there's 2.
It's a newer. Yeah. I didn't realize that. Okay, so how did you transition into your interest about vitamin K2?
I tuned into the emerging research about K2 back in 2007, early in 2007, mm-hmm. and not long before I had read Nutrition and Physical Degeneration by Weston Price. Mm-hmm. And when I learned about K2, I thought, hey, you know what, I'm sure Price talked all about this in his book. And so I went to the book and looked through it and didn't find any reference to vitamin K2, and I was really stumped. And a little bit later in 2007, read a brilliant article by Chris Masterjohn that links vitamin K2 to Price's work on activator X. And once I realized that link, you know, the light bulb went on about how important this nutrient is, how overlooked it's been for so long. It just is such, it really provides the missing piece to the puzzle of so many health conditions, and yet it was being completely overlooked despite the overwhelming amounts of modern day research. And so I figured somebody would be writing a book about it soon, and waited a little while and nobody did, and that's when I realized that I needed to do that because people need to know this information.
Terrific. I'm glad you did. As I mentioned earlier, it's really probably the best, well, it is the best book I've ever written. I haven't exhaustively reviewed the others, but I suspect it is the best book ever written on this really important topic. So can you really describe what vitamin K is for our viewers?
Sure. Vitamin K is actually a group of fat-soluble vitamins, 2 main ones. Most people are familiar with vitamin K1, and when they say vitamin K, they're referring to K1, which is found in green leafy vegetables, very easy to get in the diet.
And this is actually, excuse me for interrupting, but what we really see in the literature or in the newspapers, they hardly ever differentiate between vitamin K1 and K2. They just say vitamin K, no number attached.
Exactly, and that's created a lot of confusion. It's one of the big reasons why this important nutrient was overlooked, and still creates confusion when we learn about this nutrient. So K1, found in the green leafy vegetables, easy to get in the diet, and it exclusively participates in blood clotting. That's its only role in our health. K2 is very different. It comes from different food sources, and its role in the body is in moving calcium around. So specifically, it will guide calcium into the bones and teeth where we want it to be, and it will get calcium out of, so prevent the deposition and even remove calcium from areas where we don't want it to be, like soft tissues, arteries, for example, where calcium can cause hardening of the arteries. So K2 is really critical for keeping our bones strong and our arteries clear. So those are majorly important health concerns, and K2 is a very important nutrient for those health concerns.
And the other vitamin that we think of with calcium, of course, is vitamin D. Mm-hmm. So can you comment on the interaction between vitamin D and vitamin K2.
This is another really interesting story because we've heard so much about vitamin D and the importance of vitamin D for our health, and a lot of people are taking vitamin D, and yet D and K2 partner up together. So a lot of the health benefits that you want from vitamin D, really you need to have K2 with it for that to work. So when you take vitamin D, your body creates more of these vitamin K2 dependent proteins, the proteins that will move the calcium around. So they have a lot of potential health benefits, but until the K2 comes in to activate those proteins, those benefits aren't realized. And so really, by taking vitamin D, you're creating an increased demand for K2, and D and K2 work together to strengthen our bones and improve our heart health.
Yeah, it's really the the cement, the important part of the cement that integrates the calcium into the bone matrix.
That's right. You know, for so long, we've been told to take, say, calcium for osteoporosis. Calcium, calcium, more calcium, and vitamin D with that, which we know is helpful. Mm-hmm. But then more studies are coming out showing that increased calcium intake is causing more heart attacks and strokes. And that created a lot of confusion around whether calcium is safe or not. And really, that's the wrong question to be asking, because we'll never properly understand the health benefits of calcium or vitamin D unless we take into consideration K2, and that's what keeps the calcium in its right place.
Now, it just occurred to me that many people watching this may not really understand what a naturopathic physician is. So maybe if you can just comment on that, and then after you explain that, comment on a naturopathic physician's perspective on the sources of calcium and versus supplement versus food.
Sure. Well, a naturopathic physician, first of all, at least in my jurisdiction, certainly is a primary care physician. So somebody who would be a first point of contact for your health concerns, who can listen to your health history, give you a thorough physical exam, order and interpret blood tests if necessary. And rather than prescribing pharmaceutical medications, so rarely those are indicated and do come in handy, can treat your concerns with dietary changes, nutritional supplements, and other natural treatments that work with the body. And the most important distinguishing factor for a naturopathic physician is that we try to look at the underlying causes of your health concerns rather than just treating symptoms. And so this is where considering calcium, the recommendation for people to take calcium has become very popular. Everybody is taking calcium and vitamin D, and every doctor and even, you know, conventional medical doctors, even if the ones who won't recommend a multivitamin, will tell their patients to take calcium and vitamin D. And yet this has been a bit oversimplified. First of all, studies are showing that calcium from supplements seem to pose a greater risk for hardening of the arteries and heart attack and stroke than calcium from diet. But that being said, we have to keep in mind that heart disease, so heart attacks and stroke, is the number one killer of both men and women, whether you're taking calcium supplements or not. So we have to understand that calcium can get into the wrong places in all of us. So there certainly are lots of different sources of calcium that we can consider, and that gets into quite a lengthy debate. But the most important concern is, how do we keep calcium in the right place? So not focusing so much on the calcium, but the other nutrients like D and K2 that make calcium safe and effective.
But if someone felt, for whatever reason, that they were calcium deficient, mm-hmm. What would be your recommendation to them? Would it be to consider a calcium supplement, or to seek to find food sources of calcium?
First, to look at food sources and look at increasing calcium intake through their food sources. And it just so happens that a lot of the very high calcium foods that we would consider, like cheese, for example, are often very high in vitamin K2. And that's important, because I think nature has given us these nutrients together so they work optimally. So that is definitely the first course of action. And there are some cases in which calcium supplements are indicated. So for individuals, for example, who may have osteopenia, osteoporosis, some kind of bone loss, who find a hard time maintaining adequate calcium intake just through their diet, then therapeutically, calcium supplements do have their place and can be useful, as long as they're taken with the proper balancing nutrients. Magnesium's a big one, and of course, D and K2.
Yes. So magnesium seems to be the other stealth nutrient, mm-hmm. sort of the appropriate analogy relative to vitamin K2 to vitamin D. Magnesium would be to calcium. And there's an emerging popularity of it, an appreciation, but mm-hmm. for the most part, most of the focus seems to be on calcium when it comes to bone health.
Yeah, it has. And that's another area where certainly these calcium and heart health studies had shortcomings, because none of them took into account magnesium intake. We know that magnesium deficiency is common. And when you have magnesium deficiency, or you're lacking in magnesium and you take calcium, that can exacerbate those problems. And certainly magnesium complements K2 in a number of ways. Magnesium lowers blood pressure, and blood pressure is an important component of heart disease. So really there are a number of ways in which magnesium is also, you know, underappreciated, important part of good health, and complements K2.
So dairy foods and vegetables seem to be a reasonably good source of calcium for most people, and other minerals, of course. Potassium would be another key, which frequently gets confused with vitamin K because they both have the letter K, and K is the chemical signal for potassium.
Yes, I didn't think of that at all before I wrote the book, and then I kept getting that question. But you're right, people ask about potassium because of the chemical symbol K, but they really are
no relationship
very different
at all.
Yeah.
So calcium, the dairy and the vegetables being a good source of calcium, what would be good sources of magnesium?
Magnesium's a little more tricky. Sea vegetables are a good one, you know, kelp, dulse, nori, those things, but we know that they're not that common in people's diets. Vegetables can be a good source. Grains and whole grains are typically good sources of magnesium, but they need to be prepared properly because, as you know, whole grains can contain phytates and anti-nutrients that will ultimately block our absorption of magnesium if they're not prepared properly. And so that's a situation where a magnesium supplement for therapeutic purposes can come in very useful for people to get enough magnesium to, say, lower their blood pressure, replenish their stores, that kind of thing.
Yeah, you may not realize, but my first book that I wrote was in no grain diet, so which I've revised my precision. I don't think grain should be avoided by everyone. I think there probably is some good benefit for it, but the majority of people seem to benefit from lowering their amounts of grain.
I agree, and this whole concept of whole grain has gotten far out of control, and then multigrain, and the tricky thing with the grain is that it's just not being prepared properly, and so it certainly in my book I say if you're not going to go through the steps to prepare it properly, you probably shouldn't be eating it at all.
You probably know that in 1960 10% of the population in the United States was obese, 10%. Mm-hmm. And the recent projections are 2030, literally 70 years later, it's going to be 50%, 500% increase. And I think a large variable that contributed to that was this increase in the grains and the carbohydrates and the sugars.
Yeah, I agree, 100%.
But grains do serve a role, and I believe they are part of, used appropriately and in the right levels, can be part of a very healthy diet. Mm-hmm. As you just mentioned, magnesium is a very difficult supplement to, or mineral to acquire. I mean, I think vegetables are useful because of the magnesium seems to be an integral component of chlorophyll. I mean,
yes.
The magnesium ion substitutes for iron. Chlorophyll and hemoglobin are pretty similar.
Right.
So, but I still don't think it's in large concentration. It's certainly bioavailable in vegetables, but in chlorophyll. But if one wanted to augment or increase the amount of magnesium therapeutically, because most likely they're in a magnesium deficient state, do you have any recommendations for magnesium supplements?
I've seen good results with fairly simple magnesium citrates, even for lowering blood pressure. And, to speak to your point about it being challenging to get, we have to also keep in mind, you know, we like the idea of being able to get all of our nutrients from food, but we're also living under very stressful times, unnaturally stressful times, which really depletes our nutrients far more than we can often recover just through diet. So, you know, a magnesium supplement like magnesium citrate, I've seen good results with those for replenishing magnesium stores.
Okay. Yeah, the downside of taking magnesium as a supplement, it could be an upside for some people, is that it tends to have to loosen your stool. So it's basically serves as a laxative. And so you have to be careful of that, whereas calcium has a reverse effect, it's constipating.
Right, yeah.
Magnesium citrate, of all the supplements, seems to be one that has much less of an impact on the bowel habits. Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with magnesium threonate?
I don't have much professional experience with that because it has become more popular since I've been took a leave from my practice for having a baby and writing a book and whatnot. But I know that that's one that you have done more work with. Right?
Well, it just seems to be an emerging one that's emerging well, and primarily because of its ability to penetrate cellular membranes, mm-hmm. and mitochondrial membranes. Mm-hmm. So. Some really fascinating material on its ability to not only restore magnesium levels, but improve energy levels and actually have some impact on aging. So,
I'm really going to definitely check that out for the
research.
Next edition.
You've differentiated between vitamin K1 and K2, mm-hmm. and I'm wondering if you can give us an idea of what our needs are and what the typical person might be consuming in their diet.
Well, the optimal amounts of vitamin K2 are just being established, and we're still sort of refining that. But it seems like around 180 to 200 micrograms of vitamin K2 should be enough to activate all of our body's K2-dependent proteins to get the calcium where it needs to be and get it out of the places where it shouldn't be. So the most recent clinical trials use around those amounts of K2. And the average person is getting a lot less than that, that's for sure. In the North American diet, you can see as little as maybe 10% of that or less, and certainly not near enough to be able to optimize bone density and improve heart health.
Okay. And it gets even a little trickier, because not only is there a difference between vitamin K1 and vitamin K2, which you just mentioned, but then K2 subdivides into a whole variety of other different types, sublevels of K2. So
that's right.
Why don't you address that for a moment?
That's right. It does get a little bit technical, but this is very important for people to understand that there are different types of vitamin K2. So the two big categories of vitamin K2 that you'll find are something called MK4, which is menaquinone 4, which can be found in butter, egg yolks, and animal-based foods. That's a short-chain form of vitamin K2. And then there is a longer-chain forms that we find from fermented foods. So there's a variety of these long-chain forms. The most common one that you'll see is MK7 or menaquinone 7. And this is the one I tend to tell people to look for in supplements, because in a supplement form, the MK4 products that you will find on the shelves are actually synthetic. They are not derived from natural, say, animal source foods. Those are synthetic, which does create some confusion. Whereas the MK7, these long chain natural bacterial derived vitamin K2, is from a fermentation process. And that seems to offer a number of advantages. So the long chain form, the MK7, stays in the body longer. It has a longer half-life, which means you can just take it once a day, very convenient dosing. That's the form that's being used in the most current clinical trials on bone density and heart health. So those, you know, that long chain form is really very useful and practical.
When it's compiled or processed into a supplement, do you know a bit about that process? Is it just specifically extracting the MK7, or are there other forms that are in there too, like MK9, MK11, MK13?
So you are getting primarily MK7, because typically these are being extracted from sources like MK7 is typically extracted from natto bean. And the actual natto product has about 90% MK7 to start with. So really you're getting essentially just MK7. You may have very trace amounts of the other types of menaquinones, the technical term for vitamin K2. Whereas cheeses, for example, Gouda, very high in vitamin K2, and Brie, those will have a whole range of different types of vitamin K2.
Well, it's just like vitamin C.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you can certainly take the extract of ascorbic acid and take it in high doses in supplement, but, you know, the long-standing question has been, is that as useful or valuable as the food extracted source, where you have all these other ancillary micronutrients
right.
that support the bioflavonoids particularly?
Right, and you can see the same example with the vitamin E, the various tocopherols,
sure.
and a number of nutrients like that.
Tocotrienols,
yeah.
And you know, the alpha gamma delta. So I was thinking that it would be a similar situation here with vitamin K2, that the whole balance in the range, not just extracting the vitamin MK7, would be beneficial, because there would probably be some supporting role of all the other versions.
That's likely the case. Certainly the clinical trials are only using an extract typically of just the one form, but you know, as Mother Nature provides us with them in a whole package of all these different ones, they likely work together.
So as you mentioned, the average person is probably only getting 10% of their vitamin K2 requirement,
mm-hmm.
predisposing them.
Mm-hmm.
First of all, let's get into that area. What does this fact mean? What does that translate to? The fact
Good
that
point.
People are
right.
only taking 10% of what there are recently appreciated understanding of what their optimal needs are.
Right. So this ultimately leaves us at risk for osteoporosis, heart disease, heart attack, and stroke, as well as a number of cancers. So, I talked about vitamin K2 moving calcium around the body. Its other main role is to activate proteins that control cell growth. So that means K2 has a very important role to play in cancer protection. So when we're lacking K2, we're at much greater risk for osteoporosis, heart disease, and cancer. And these are three concerns that used to be relatively rare. And over the last 100 years, as we've changed the way we produce our food and the way we eat, they have become very common. And the lack of K2 is playing a really big role there.
Is there any connection to neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's?
Oh, definitely. Yeah, there was a lot of research, there's a fair amount of research on that. And I think that's the area of research around vitamin K2 that has the most potential, or maybe is lacking and more work needs to be done. But neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's and even multiple sclerosis and a number of other neurological concerns.
Okay, so it's really important that you pay attention to this nutrient, because there's a bulk of emerging research that's supporting this very strongly, probably every bit as much as vitamin D. But vitamin D, of course, has received much of the attention clinically. And I believe this were partially related to the fact that in the late 90s, there was a commercial assay to test for vitamin D that became available, because for 100 years, we knew it was connected to rickets, and that was about it.
Right.
But as we've developed an inexpensive assay to test for it.
Okay, so that is an amazingly detailed and informative and revolutionary video about vitamin K2 preventing cancer and doing many other things in the body which are very important for good health. And also, it's made clear there in that interview that vitamin K2 is also very, very poorly known. In other words, it's virtually an unknown vitamin, which is absolutely crucial for human health. And because we have stopped, for example, in many cases, we've stopped feeding our animals with the grass of years past, and with seeing as grass, in fact, is a good source of the necessary nutrients required for the production of K2 in the animals' dairy products and in the animals' meat. Grass-fed animals have vitamin K2 in them, in the dairy and the meat, whereas non-grass-fed, or animals that are fed something else other than grass, which has been oftentimes the case in recent years, grass-fed products are, meat and dairy, meat and dairy products, which are from grass-fed animals, are less common in recent times. So this explains why cancer has been on the uptick, or on the rise in recent years, because vitamin K2 has been more deficient in our diets. And vitamin K2, as far as how much we can take, it's got zero known toxicity. And I think they're going to probably talk about that later on in that video too. But the thing is, there is no known correct dose of vitamin K2. And in that interview, Dr. Rayon Blue also mentions that she took three times the recommended vitamin K2 while she was pregnant with her child. That she mentioned there, she had a child recently, but she was taking three times the recommended amount, because there is no recommended amount of vitamin K2 that really makes any sense, because K2 is not known to be toxic in any sense. It's unlike vitamin D, although it's very important for the processing of vitamin D in the body, by the body. So vitamin D is toxic to the body, but vitamin K2 has zero known toxicity. Vitamin D is of course, essential, but it has a known toxicity, just like water has a known toxicity. And we need water. It's essential. It's just that it does have toxicity, whereas vitamin K2, not only do we need it, but it has no known toxicity. So they've used it in Japan in 45 times the recommended, 45 times the recommended daily amount to reverse osteoporosis, and they've done that in Japan for decades. That's something they don't talk about. I don't believe that she talks about that particular thing. I've watched that video or part of it in the past. I'm going to watch it later, but for now, let's go to our study of Psalm 87 of the sons of Korah, a melody, a song. His foundation is in the holy mountains. Jehovah is more in love with the gates of Zion than with all the tabernacles of Jacob. Glorious things are being spoken about you, O city of the true God. Selah. I shall make mention of Rahab and Babylon as among those knowing me. Here Philistia and Tyre together with Cush. This is one who was born there. Here are Philistia and Tyre along together with Cush. Here are Philistia and Tyre together with Cush. This is one who was born there. And respecting Zion, it will be said, each and every one was born in her. And the Most High himself will firmly establish her. Jehovah himself will declare when recording the peoples, this is one who was born there, Selah. There will also be singers as well as dancers of circle dances. All my springs are in you. That's a very poetic sounding psalm of the sons of Korah. Psalm 87, that was. Jehovah is more in love with the gates of Zion than with all the tabernacles of Jacob. It's a beautiful expression of endearment by Jehovah for the city of Jerusalem, or Zion, as it's called in the scriptures. Now, Matthew 17. This is a fairly short one. I think this is going to be the transfiguration. Yes. 6 days later, Jesus took Peter and James and John, his brother, along and brought them up into a lofty mountain by themselves. And he was transfigured before them. And his face shone as the sun. And his outer garments became brilliant as the light. And look, there appeared to them Moses and Elijah conversing with him. Responsibly, Peter said to Jesus, Lord, it is fine for us to be here. If you wish, I will erect three tents here, one for you, and one for Moses, and one for Elijah. While he was yet speaking, look, a bright cloud overshadowed them, and look, a voice out of the cloud saying, this is my son, the beloved, whom I have approved. Listen to him. At hearing this, the disciples fell upon their faces and became very much afraid. Then Jesus came near and, touching them, said, get up and have no fear. When they raised their eyes, they saw no one but Jesus himself only. And as they were descending from the mountain, Jesus commanded them, saying, tell the vision to no one until the Son of Man is raised up from the dead. However, the disciples put the question to him, why then do the scribes say that Elijah must come first? In reply, he said, Elijah indeed is coming and will restore all things. However, I say to you that Elijah has already come, and they did not recognize him, but did with him the things they wanted. In this way also the Son of Man is destined to suffer at their hands. Then the disciples perceived that he spoke to them about John the Baptist. And when they came toward the crowd, a man approached him, kneeling down to him and saying, Lord, have mercy on my son, because he is an epileptic and is ill, for he falls often into the fire and often into the water. And I brought him to your disciples, but they could not cure him. In reply, Jesus said, O faithless and twisted generation, how long must I continue with you? How long must I put up with you? Bring him here to me. Then Jesus rebuked it, and the demon came out of him, and the boy was cured from that hour. Thereupon the disciples came up to Jesus privately and said, why is it we could not expel it? he said to them, because of your little faith. For truly I say to you, if you have faith the size of a mustard grain, you will say to this mountain, transfer from here to there, and it will transfer, and nothing will be impossible for you. It was while they were gathered together in Galilee that Jesus said to them, the Son of Man is destined to be betrayed into men's hands. They will kill him, and the third day he will be raised up. Consequently, they were very much grieved. After they arrived in Capernaum, the men collecting the 2 drachmas tax approached Peter and said, does your teacher not pay the 2 drachmas tax? He said, yes. However, when he entered the house, Jesus got ahead of him by saying, what do you think, Simon? From whom do the kings of the earth receive duties or head tax? From their sons or from the strangers? When he said, from the strangers, Jesus said to him, really then, the sons are tax-free, but that we do not cause them to stumble. You go to the sea, cast a fish hook, take the first fish coming up, and when you open its mouth, you will find a stater coin. Take that and give it to them for me and you. That was Matthew chapter 17. So, I want to talk more about Dr. Kate Realm Blue, but perhaps we will just continue the video somewhat longer here.
Commercially available, then the interest in it sort of exploded. The parallel of that, however, with vitamin K2 specifically, is that there still, to this day, is no assay. It's basically a research tool,
right,
which probably explains why there's such a lack of appreciation of this, because there's just not the logistical infrastructure to make it easy to do research on this.
Exactly, and that is, it does speak to the challenge of K2, because a lot of the concerns of K2 are so internal, right? You can't look at somebody and see that they have bone density problems, or they're on the road to
just
heart
like
disease.
Vitamin D.
Exactly, and so much of heart disease goes undetected, even with all their technology, goes undetected until a heart attack strikes. And so that's where we really like to have a test to say, okay, to show I'm absolutely deficient in vitamin K2, and yet the best tests are just not available through clinicians. They really are, as you said, research tools being used in academic settings, and they're not available and out there yet. That being said, research has shown that the majority of adults are in fact deficient in this nutrient. And by deficient, I mean that they don't have enough K2 to keep calcium in its right place at all times, increasing our risk for osteoporosis and heart disease and cancer.
And brain disease.
And brain disease and a number of other health concerns. I mean, any kind of inappropriate calcification, kidney stones, heel spurs, even small things where calcium shouldn't be. And yet without that test, people remain doubtful. So I know that's coming. You know, it wasn't too long ago that we didn't have the test for vitamin D, and now we do. But in the meantime, we really can't afford to wait until we have that test to start getting the K2 back into our diets.
Terrific. One of the important principles that you alluded to is, I think it's a pretty profound principle in naturopathic medicine, in that they're really, most disease progresses to the point, on average, where there's typically 80%. You're 80% of the way there before you have the first symptom.
Mm-hmm.
And in some diseases, it's 100%.
Yeah.
Like a heart attack. You could have a fatal heart attack, have no symptoms at all,
mm-hmm,
and then you're dead.
Yep.
So that is really crucial to understand this process that exists. So I'm wondering if you could comment, or if you've seen in your review of the literature on K2, about the prevalence. You said the majority of people have this, but I know this. I wonder if you can get more specific, because the at least the initial research, and may have changed since the attention has been, mm-hmm, focused on vitamin D, but it was 85% of the people did not have therapeutic levels of vitamin D. And this was even obscured too, because what is a therapeutic level? What is an optimal,
right,
level? Because most of the initial research prior to the 90s was focusing on, you know, above 20 nanograms per milliliter. I don't know what's
so
used
low
in nanograms or
nanograms.
You know, because Europe uses a different standard,
yeah,
for the index. But now we know it's over 50, you know,
right,
literally 2 to 3 times higher than,
right,
the original. So I'm wondering if there's a comparable specific statement with respect to the number of people, the specific percentage. Is it just sort of generic majority, or is it more specific than that?
Right now it's generic majority, but you know, looking at the studies, we're seeing an overwhelming majority of people who are deficient in K2. So 80% and plus simply don't have all of their K2 proteins activated. And that is critical, and it's not surprising given the amount of heart disease and osteoporosis, cancer, and diabetes as well that's implicated.
Right. So pretty similar to vitamin D.
Very much
they're, yeah. Not only, and there's another similarity in that they're both fat-soluble vitamins.
Yes, that's right. And that's an important similarity because these really are the foundation of our health. They allow us, these fat-soluble vitamins, to make use of all of the other nutrients that we get into our bodies. And that's important. And even, you know, when you talked about the debate on what is an optimal range of vitamin D, and that still continues, how much vitamin D should you be taking? And I do speak about that in the book because ultimately the answer to that question is it depends. And it depends to a certain extent on your K2. We see a lot of health benefits of vitamin D where D is healthy and helpful to a certain point, after which point we see harm with it. And where that point is depends a lot on how much K2 you have in your body. So, you know, the more D you take, the greater demand you create in your body for K2 and the greater potential you stand to get from taking K2. So they really do work together in so many ways.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of getting the majority, if not the all of your vitamin D from exposing your skin to sunlight. And then secondarily, if that's not available, especially for Canadians and most people in North America,
right.
Northern North America would be, you know, safe tanning bed because it's the closest approximation.
Mm-hmm.
But clearly that's not going to be available for everyone, so we have to make a concession and swallow oral.
Yeah.
But I haven't taken oral vitamin D for years. Mm-hmm. So this is a really important point. I wonder if you can expand on it because it's really crucial and it's something that we don't emphasize enough, and I'd like to start doing that on a really consistent basis, is to warn people the dangers of taking oral vitamin D without the vitamin K2. So I'm wondering if you could give some parameters and guidelines on how to frame it and what people should be thinking of before they make this decision to swallow oral vitamin D.
That's a really good point because there are so many people on the vitamin D mega dose bandwagon taking more and more of D, and it could absolutely be causing harm if you are lacking the K2 to complete the job to get the calcium where it's supposed to be. We know that the symptoms, we don't see symptoms of detoxicity very often, but when we do, those symptoms are inappropriate calcification. That's a symptom of detoxicity, and that is actually a lack of vitamin K2 that will cause that. K2 protects you against that toxicity, quite simply. And so when we talk about nutrients together, we like to hear about ratios and optimal ratios, and that hasn't been perfectly elucidated, but I would say for every 1,000 international units of vitamin D you're taking, you should look at least 100 micrograms of K2, if not, you know, the 150 to 200 range, something like that, to try to ease it.
That's a pretty large dose because, you know, we work with Carol Baggerly from Grassroots Health,
mm-hmm.
and she's done a study she's
you know, the 150 to 100 micrograms units of vitamin D are elucidated, but I would say for every 1,000 international units of vitamin D you're taking, you should look at least 100 micrograms of K2, if not, you know, the 150 to 200 range, something like that, to try to ease
it up. That's a pretty large dose because, you know, we work with Carol Baggerly from Grassroots Health,
mm-hmm.
and she's done a study she's analyzed the level of vitamin D, oral vitamin D supplementation that's required to reach a therapeutic level of about mm-hmm. 50 nanograms per milliliter. And she found that was about 8,000 units. So you previously had stated that the typical dose for someone is K2 would be about 150 micrograms, 200 micrograms. So if they were taking 8,000, would they have to take a milligram of vitamin K2?
800 to...
That's a lot of vitamin K2. It's a supplement.
Yes, that's right. So that was my earlier recommendation was not taking into account people who are doing high-dose vitamin D supplementation. Mm-hmm. So that's where it gets a little bit more technical. It seems that for the average person, 200 micrograms, around 200, 180 to 200 micrograms, will activate your K2 proteins and do a lot of good for your bones and your heart. Mm-hmm. If you're taking high levels of vitamin D, or, you know, 8,000 international units, that kind of thing, then I would recommend taking more K2.
Okay. That's really as high as a milligram?
As high as a milligram. Again, this is where we need to do a little bit more testing.
That would be 1,000 micrograms. Can't do the math.
Yeah, that's right. But we need to be doing a little bit more, we need to do a little bit more study on that particular aspect of the ratio
between
those.
Well, let's talk about toxicity, because that's the counter side.
Right.
Because
okay.
A lot of the supplements we recommend, like astaxanthin or ubiquinol, essentially there's no known toxicities. Ubiquinol for sure, maybe very large doses of astaxanthin. But what is the toxicity of a large dose of vitamin K2?
That's the really good news. K2 has no toxicity. There is no known toxic effects. This is something that we see again and again in the literature. That's surprising for people to hear, because we're used to, with fat-soluble vitamins, there being a potential for toxicity. The reason why K2 doesn't have a potential toxic effect is because all that K2 does is activate K2 proteins. It'll activate all the K2 proteins it finds, and if they're all activated and you take extra K2, it simply won't do that. And so that's why we don't see a potential for toxicity the way we do with A or D. So that's really good news about K2, and why you don't necessarily need to wait for a test, because we know a lot of good health benefits and no downside. So it's a good thing for you to be taking.
Yeah, I spoke to Dr. Vermeer, who's one of the leading researchers in this. He was really adamant about that too. No known toxicity at any doses.
Right.
And just getting back to the interconnection with vitamin D, it would seem that the reason for the increased need for vitamin K2 when you're taking high dose of vitamin D is that vitamin D somehow stimulates or activates these vitamin K2 proteins.
Exactly.
And if they don't, so the protein goes unactivated by vitamin K2. There's more of them. That's why you need more vitamin K2.
Exactly. By taking D, you are essentially creating a greater demand in your body for K2. So if you take D at high doses for a long time and don't have the K2, that's when you're going to start to see problems. Or at the very least, you'll be missing out on a lot of the benefits that you want from your D.
Now, this is a really important part, maybe one of the most important parts of the interview, is that because of the fact that there is no vitamin K2 test, so let's create one empirically.
Mm.
How would you, what type of quiz would you give a person to know that if their answer to these questions is no, then the likelihood of them being vitamin K2 deficient is very, very high, considering 85% of the people watching this are K2 deficient. And I'm sure we're both in agreement.
Yes.
That the ideal way to get your vitamin K2 is not through a supplement.
Mm, yeah.
It's through food.
Yes.
And that's the way we're designed to do it. So why don't you see if you could take a stab at answering that question to give people a tool, a resource, so that they can identify if they're at risk.
Right. Well, there's two ways you can identify this. You can go through a long list of health concerns and symptoms, you know, osteoporosis, heart disease, diabetes, all of these things. If you have any of those concerns, then you are likely K2 deficient, because those are all connected to K2.
By concern, you mean you actually have these conditions.
You have these conditions.
Not just worried about.
That's right. But for the people who don't have those conditions yet, because those can go silent, progress for many years, it's very simple. Do you eat grass-fed foods? Do your eggs and butter and dairy products come from animals that are grazed on pasture? If not, then you're probably low in vitamin K2. Do you eat certain types of special fermented foods? Natto, it's a fermented Japanese soybean food, is the highest food in vitamin K2, which virtually nobody is eating here in North America, certainly in some areas of Japan. And or high amounts of goose liver pate, or brie cheese or gouda. These sound like unusual foods, but they are the cornerstones of certain European, very healthy European diets. So this has been shown to be, so first of all, important thing to mention when it comes to cheese, because this becomes an area of confusion, that because cheese is a bacterial-derived form of vitamin K2, it actually doesn't matter if the cheese came from grass-fed milk. That would be nice, but it's not the grass-fed milk that went into the cheese. It's the bacteria making the cheese, which means it doesn't matter if you're importing your brie from France or getting it domestically. Brie cheese, the bacteria that makes brie cheese, will make vitamin K2.
Is that one that's specifically high in K2?
That's one that's specifically high. Brie and Gouda are two cheeses that are quite specifically high, as well as...
And what's the concentration per ounce typically?
So you're looking at about 75 micrograms per ounce, something
so
like that.
So you need 3 ounces.
3 ounces. So that's a fair amount of cheese.
Yeah, not insignificant.
Right, that's right. That's a fair amount of cheese. And, you know, as much as you love cheese, it's still hard to eat that much of it. And yet...
And those are the high concentration cheese, because most of the other cheeses are lower, right?
That's right. Most of the other cheeses are lower. Now, the research also did mention a curd cheese, but I'm trying to discern in North America what that means, because there's a number of different types of cheeses that would fall under that category. But it still takes a fair amount of cheese to get this. But the benefits are substantial. So in the population-based studies that show that K2 levels will decrease your risk of heart disease and prostate cancer, it was actually cheese consumption that was the major determinant of that K2 intake. So it was cheese intake that was protecting those individuals from heart disease and prostate cancer.
Very interesting. Yeah. And my guess is that, and certainly both of us are not fans of pasteurized dairy, but if you were to consume pasteurized dairy, that does that affect the K2 levels, or is it immune to pasteurization?
That's a question that has keeps coming up and has not been examined. Certainly K2 is affected somewhat by heat. It's not obliterated by heat, but somewhat. But frankly, it just hasn't been studied yet. So we don't know whether pasteurization affects that. Fortunately, since the bacteria for culturing and making cheese are added afterwards, if the milk was pasteurized before, again, with cheese, you're safe. With grass-fed milk, we don't know.
Okay. Yeah. And how about some of the common commercially used cheeses, like cottage cheese or American cheese?
Right. So
American cheese.
Cottage cheese could very well fall into the category of this curd cheese that was considered to be very high in vitamin K2, but I didn't mention it in the book because I wanted to make sure I was recommending people eat the right types of cheeses before we say specifically which ones. Cheddar did make the list of having some K2 in there, but you'd have to probably eat about a pound of cheddar a day to get a therapeutic amount there. And those were the big ones that have been tested. There hasn't been extensive testing
done.
We
know all that fat would increase your risk of heart disease, so we wouldn't recommend that.
Right. Fortunately, the K2 protects from that. So
no, I was just kidding.
Yeah, I know. But this goes back to this.
Okay, I think that's enough for today. I highly recommend that everybody watch this video. It's a must-see, because it is going to determine what disease you will get or won't get, very likely, and it's going to determine how long you live, whether you get Alzheimer's, whether you get cancer, very likely is this vitamin K2. That's going to be the determining factor, is vitamin K2. It's called the calcium facilitator vitamin, and Kate Raume's book, she called it a provocative title. She gave it a provocative title. I'm not sure what the calcium paradox is, but it makes the book more provocative because she called it vitamin K2 and the calcium paradox when she wrote her. That was her book that she wrote. I haven't read that book either. I should read the book, and I should watch more interviews by her. But I remembered and retained virtually everything she said the first time I watched whatever part of this interview I watched, because as I'm watching it again, I remember virtually everything she's saying. However, it does get gradually slanted and twisted over time. So some of it has been altered. My memory has been altered over time of some of the things she said, but it's just really vital that everybody listen to this if they're going to do any kind of vitamin supplementation, or if they just want to be healthy. Anybody who wants to be healthy should listen to this interview. But we should all pay attention to the information that's available about vitamin K2 now. Seriously neglected vitamin. Within the within the spectrum of all the vitamins that people are aware of today, why would we neglect a vitamin as important as vitamin K2? I mean, it doesn't make any sense when vitamin K2 is not only is it not toxic to any degree at all, which it isn't. It's not known to be, that is, it's not known to be toxic in any way at all. And so why are we not taking more of it, or at least taking some of it and then experimenting with taking more of it, which is what I've been doing for a while, because I know that it's beneficial, I know that it's helped me already. And then I realized, well, wait a minute, why am I restricting myself in how much I'm taking? Perhaps if I take more K2, and along with it, we need more vitamin D as well, and we need calcium with it too. But if we take more, and if I'm thinking, if I take more, it might reverse more of my health problems, or it might give me younger organs, younger skin, younger body. It's good for the whole body. It improves circulation. It reverses many conditions such as heart disease, arthritis. The list of things that it does I don't even think it reverses osteoporosis, for heaven's sake. I mean, the number of things it does, vitamin K2, it's just like we got to stop talking about it, because we got to get out to the store and get some. That's how urgent it is, and that's how seriously beneficial it is. Forget about talking about it. I mean, the research has been done, but yet it hasn't. But we know, but there's no toxicity. It's not like it can hurt you. As far as we know, it can't hurt you. And it has enormous numbers of benefits, of all kinds of health benefits. All kinds of health benefits, vitamin K2. Dr. Kate Rayon-Blue is Canadian. She's from Ontario, Canada. She's a naturopathic doctor. And she's the world's foremost expert on vitamin K2. And this is an interview she had with Dr. Mercola. It was more than a year ago, but this particular copy of the interview was published a year ago on the channel on YouTube called Health Odyssey. Now she was interviewed by Dr. Mercola. It was before, I believe it was before 2016, because I knew about it then, as far as I recollect. This is an old interview. It's from, this might be as old as 2005 or something. I'm not sure. That number is stuck in my head here. I'm not sure when that came out. Now, Mercola might have a copy of it on his website. I looked for it just now to see if this video is available on YouTube in some other form. But Kate Rayon-Blue has many videos of her own, many other videos. And I haven't watched any of those, because this interview by Mercola was so good. I haven't watched it. But calcium's available too on Amazon. But vitamin K2 is available on Amazon now in a liquid form, which is the MK4 And that would be, like she said, it would be synthetic. But whether it's synthetic or not is sort of irrelevant. It's the same exact molecule that is present in the body. So what's the difference if it's synthetic or not? I'm not sure there is a difference. Now, for her, she's a naturopathic doctor, so for her, it makes a difference. But for someone who's a doctor who's, or a person who's not a holder of the beliefs of naturopathy, the important thing may be simply the chemical formula of the molecule, and that's all that really might matter to somebody who is not naturopathically based. So the fact that it's synthetic is irrelevant if it's identical to the molecule that we manufacture in our bodies. It is going to be possibly better or worse, you know, to take one form or another form, and that has to be, that those are the things that need to be investigated. MK7 is the form that I started out taking, and I ended up taking as many as maybe 20 of them per day before I started thinking, well, you know, not every day maybe, but I think most days I was taking more than 12 of them per day, and I was swallowing a lot of gel caps, which are not, I don't want to have to process all the gelatin. It's just so, but also I realized I wasn't getting the MK4. Now I'm going to start eating more brie cheese. I just realized, if I can get some, because Gouda is not always available where I'm shopping, or I'm going to order Gouda maybe from Amazon. I'm going to start eating these cheeses because they have the other chain forms of vitamin K2, the longer chain forms, and they have the natural MK4. They've also got, you know, MK7 and longer chain forms of vitamin K2 in these cheeses. And other things are possible. Maybe cottage cheese is rich in K2. And if that's the case, I'll be eating cottage cheese. But I haven't done that research myself either. But at this point, she had not determined that herself about cottage cheese. But the number of ways we get it through food, though, is fairly restricted. And that's why we eat, unless we eat natto, which is the best way to get MK7. It's a Japanese fermented soybean dish. For those people who eat that, they won't need any more MK7 because that's the best source of it. But they might want to supplement with MK4, which is, for example, Thorn, the laboratory. The Thorn Research produces the liquid MK4 supplement, which is for sale on Amazon. So I think I've said enough. I can't stop talking about it, but I mean, I know I have a little more time here. We're already over an hour, though, so I think that's enough for today. We've had an abbreviated study. I hope people are enjoying their food during their holidays, if they're having any holidays right now. The thing is about food is it's easy to overeat when you don't have the right nutrients. When you've got the right nutrients, the main nutrient that our body seems to need is vitamin K2. That plus calcium and magnesium and vitamin D. Those are the main nutrients. If we have the correct nutrients, we're not as hungry for other nutrients, because on the other hand, or the flip side of that, is if we don't have the crucial nutrients, we're always going to be hungry for anything that we can get to try to fill the void that that the lack of those key nutrients has created in our bodies. So we're going to be overeating because we're hungry, because we're not getting enough K2 or calcium or vitamin D or magnesium. If we need those and we're not getting them, our bodies keep craving. So overeating is caused by misinformation with regard to what food is needed, you know, or what nutrients are needed by the body. That's what overeating is caused by. So that if you do know what foods your body needs and you take sufficient quantities of those foods, you won't be starving or craving food all the time, and therefore you won't eat as much. But obesity is headed for on a path for, as they said here, Mercola said, I believe it was, he said 50% of people in North America or the U.S. will be obese or overweight, you know, grossly overweight by the year 2030. 50%. And just can you imagine that? 50%. Obese is not just slightly overweight. It's severely overweight people. 50% of people are going to be overweight by the year 2030 at the current rate at the time of this interview. So hopefully we can reverse that using vitamin K2, calcium, and vitamin D and magnesium, which is essential along with calcium. Magnesium and calcium together are always essential to be, that they, it's always essential that they be together with half as much magnesium as calcium in terms of milligrams. And just for reference, 1,000 micrograms equals 1 milligram. 1,000 milligrams equals 1 gram. Okay, so 1,000 milligrams equals 1 gram, and 1,000 micrograms equals 1 milligram. So that there's no confusion, or hopefully less confusion about that. This is Ward Green. It's December 27th, 2022. It's 18:23 hours. God bless you. I love you. Thank you for listening and watching. Have a wonderful day. Bye for now.